This is CliffCentral.com.
All right. Little Norman Greenbaum. Spirit in the Sky. Love this. Mm. All right, we got to get our attention turned immediately to the Henry Van Breda case. Mubs, they started yesterday with his testimony, right?
Yes, they did. I guess after the judge came back and decided that, nope, we will be live streaming the testimony. So, yeah, they had to get things going yesterday.
Oh, right. Well, my was juicy.
Well, someone who's been here as a guest on our show before, she was expert at covering the Oscar Pistorius trial, and here I think an even more gruesome murder, certainly getting a lot less attention than Oscar, but still one that is extremely newsworthy, is Karen Morn from ENCA. She's on the line. Karen, thank you for taking some time out of your day today. I know you work very hard covering all of these stories. The Henry Van Breda trial's got everybody talking, but nobody really was prepared for the fact that he would take the witness stand himself and start to give his own testimony. You listened to all of it yesterday. What were your impressions?
I think it was such a different experience because obviously, you know, the precedent that we have for this kind of thing is Pistorius. That was the first case where you saw trial evidence, and obviously that was just his audio. Now we're actually seeing Henry Van Breda's face. And in contrast to Pistorius, which was so emotional with the blue bucket and the retching and the crying, mm-hmm. you know, here you have a person who, on his own version, his family was basically massacred by the so-called two alleged axe murderers, unknown according to him. And just the calmness was astounding. I mean, maybe he's just someone who's massively in control of his own emotions, but I mean, he's 22. His whole family is dead except for his sister, who, you know, hasn't testified, and who I understand has, you know, suffered quite profound neurological damage because of the injuries she sustained. And he's absolutely calm. I mean, it was fascinating to watch. I think anyone who was watching it was just literally transfixed, waiting to see what was going to happen next.
I want to play a clip before you carry on, and then we'll get some more insight from you in a second, of Van Breda talking about defending himself against an attacker, just so that people can get an idea of what he sounded like while he was on the stand. Listen to this.
Saying that he moved your at some stage, then moved.
This is the counsel asking him questions.
Yes, he twisted his arm with the knife downwards, and this left my hand rather precariously holding onto his, and as a result of which I realized that I wasn't going to be able to keep hold of his arm. He was busy trying to stab me.
One moment. Just demonstrate again using your right hand or right arm being the attacker.
Yes.
Holding the knife in which way? Clockwise or anti-clockwise, did he move his arm?
From his point of view, clockwise.
And I mean, he's so lucid and composed, right?
Well, also that evidence is important because, I mean, one of the evidence the state has laid is that there's a thumbprint on the knife. So a lot of that was, look, this is, you know, I was holding it and I touched the knife and sort of saying to the court, this would explain why I would have this thumbprint on this so-called murder weapon, but very composed. I mean, he would say things like, I was scared, you know, I was afraid, etc. That's why I didn't intervene when these people were attacking my family. But there was no real sense of emotion. And I mean, you could make the argument, maybe he's on sedatives, we know he's seeing a therapist, etc., etc. But when one listens to the Netcare 911 phone call that he made straight after his whole family, except for his sister, is you know, mortally wounded, dying, etc., etc., it's that same monotone. It's like, yeah, you know, you have to turn the street. And then people initially thought, you know, the Netcare people thought this guy's pranking us.
Yeah, I mean, he doesn't sound like someone who's just lost his whole family. And even in that call, which we've heard over and over again, I mean, here he is talking about whether or not he asked the neighbors for help. When he was outside, he just calmly says, no, he didn't. Listen to
it was
this.
Open. What did you do?
I went out the back door and stopped when I could see down the side wall of the house. I couldn't see anyone there. And then I went back inside the house.
Now, at that stage, Mr. Van Bedaar, at the back door, the attack that has happened, did you call for help to your neighbours at that stage?
No, I didn't.
I mean, that's all he said. He really, obviously he's been coached into saying as little as possible. But Karen, did you get the impression at all that this is someone who is completely stable, or did you get the impression that this is someone who's who's crazy? I mean, like, in order to be so unemotional, you almost have to be a little bit crazy.
Well, I mean, the classic line was when he said, with hindsight, you know, maybe I should have called someone. But I think the picture is as well, you know, on his own version, his sister is upstairs. She's moving her arms. He's talking about his brother making gurgling noises. These people were not dead. So, you know, God help us if you're ever in that situation. But if someone had attacked a sibling of mine and they are gurgling, and I think that I'm going to be screaming my head off. I'm going to be calling every emergency service. It gets worse because he didn't call. He said, no, he was Googling for the numbers and looking on the fridge and all of this kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. But he calls his girlfriend first. Like, that is what blows my mind. You're saying to the court, my brother was making gurgling noises. You know, ergo, he's still alive. My sister, I see her moving. You know, he doesn't really go into descriptors. He said there was a lot of blood. You know, there was blood everywhere, etc. But if you, you know, never mind anything else, if it's, you know, it's your family, you want them to survive. It just boggles the mind that this would be a reaction. I mean, I think they're going to, you know, need to seek some kind of psychologist evidence or something to explain this kind of choice of behavior that he made, which seems just totally antithetical to what a normal human being would do.
And he's very articulate, and they said that he had a stutter, and that was one of the reasons they didn't want the testimony broadcast. It seems to me he was quite erudite up there.
No, we didn't see any sign of the stutter. Remember when he was arguing that, you know, he didn't want his testimony broadcast, his lawyer actually raised the stutter as a point. Yeah. Peter Burton said, look, you know, it's going to be overwhelming. It's stressful for him. And Judge Desai just said, well, you know, I won't hold it against the guy, you know, and basically dismissed that argument and said, we're broadcasting this. And, you know, when he got on the stand, he was fine. I mean, there were even these weird little attempts at humor where, you know, he was saying that, you know, he was talking about a particular thing and saying it was reasonably possible. And the prosecutor said to him, you know, do you understand what reasonably possible actually means? And he said, reasonably, and then gave a little smile. So it's this weird, it's kind of, when you consider the subject matter of what he's talking about and his demeanor, I think a lot of people would look at that and think this is a very strange situation. But I mean, maybe this is the guy's personality. Maybe beneath all of this, you know, calm, erudite, composed little, you know, attempts at humor, there's deep, deep, you know, trauma, etc. But we just simply aren't seeing that.
Wow. It must have been quite, you watched the whole thing and you were paying attention to all of it. I mean, it must have been incredibly unnerving, because I get the sense that his lawyer is trying really hard to put some kind of case together. But it would seem to me that at this stage, in the absence of any other party being charged with a crime here, with anyone else being brought in as a potential suspect, that this is almost a foregone conclusion, and we're just checking the reasonable doubt category.
Yeah, I mean, it's difficult because they, you know, there's other evidence. There's the evidence of the neighbor that she heard these raised male voices between, I think, about 10 and midnight that night. And you see, the thing is, in South African law, you know, proving a motive is not a prerequisite of guilt. So it's going to be one of these cases where the matrix of evidence must be considered by the court in order to reach a conclusion. And, you know, one of the allegations that the state is making is that, you know, he attempted to stage the crime scene. He threw the axe at the wall. He's, you know, through his evidence, trying to give explanations for it. And those explanations are very calm. And it's going to be interesting to see what happens when Susan Galloway, who is a very, very experienced prosecutor, starts really getting into that cross-examination and lifting up the improbabilities of what he is saying. But, you know, it's going to be a case where the judge is really going to have to pull all that matrix and the improbabilities and the kind of, you know, hardcore DNA factual evidence, including the evidence of the medical experts, which was suggesting that he had actually inflicted the injuries, inverted commas, that he'd sustained on himself. All of that's going to have to come into the mix to get a conviction. But it's not a slam dunk, I think. I think it's going to really depend on the judge to sort of look at the whole evidence and craft a judgment that whatever he decides is not going to be subjected to an appeal and a successful appeal.
It's a frightening story. I mean, I can't imagine the kind of carnage and horror that the police found when they eventually got to that house that morning.
In terms of the law, just a quick question, excuse me. In terms of the law, to what extent, if any, does his vibe on the stand? No, I mean, I'm only slightly joking. I don't know what you would call it, demeanor. To what extent, if any, does his vibe, is it allowed to or should it influence the judge? Because the judge has obviously got to factor in a whole lot of decisions. You go, I just don't buy this deadpan smirk guy's dickhead vibe. Can that be factored into a legal argument?
Not in those words.
No, but you know what I mean.
No, I don't. No, if the Raj Desai is going to use the word dickhead in his ruling, I would suspect that if he did, we might be all in the SCA in a couple of months' time. But, you know, the court can look at things, you know, like, for instance, if we look at the Pistorius example, I mean, the court, you know, made a lot of pronouncements around, you know, his level of emotion in the court, his level of evidence, and during the actual commission of the crime, and made observations around that and observations of witnesses in terms of that. So, of course, you know, it plays a role, but it cannot be a basis for a determination of guilt or not guilt, because people react to things in different ways. And if someone is highly emotive versus someone who is not, that can't be a determination by the court as to, you know, whether someone is guilty or not. However, if someone, you know, shows, it's going to really be down to the cross-examination. How does Susan Galloway then say to him, but, you know, your family's mortally wounded, why are you not calling ambulance? Like, what reasonable person? Also, you know, for me, like, things like, did you not, because he said he saw his brother on the bed, he saw his brother being attacked, he was too scared to intervene. But then subsequently, when this person, this attacker is there, he's all ready to fight with him to defend his own life. So why is there this seeming discrepancy between those two behaviors? Why does it seem like the one attacker was in the room and the other one was not? You know, he says now there are these two people. Now, you know, if I'm attacker one and attacker two, and I'm in the house and this pesky white boy is now trying to, like, stop me from doing anything, am I not going to go and help my attacker compatriot to deal with this person? I mean, hello. And then, of course, the other problem, nothing was stolen.
Yeah,
so
nothing.
You've got people who managed to get into a security estate, evade CCTV cameras, evade all the high security that's there,
on
not get caught
on
camera.
The way in and out.
In and out, of course.
And they've never found any breach in that security, have they?
No. And then do this horrific massacre. And no one, and before these raised voices, et cetera, get out. And then, you know, seemingly because that's what you do, you know, just massacre an entire family and there's no real payoff for you. Why would you do that? And I mean, Henry van Bredaar and the family members have all acknowledged this was not a family that, you know, was engaged in questionable or illicit activities. They were, you know, very reputable family. There was no bad blood with the business. So it just doesn't make sense, I think, for any right-thinking person.
But also, Karen, I mean, if you are two attackers and you manage to kill three family members, severely wound the fourth, surely you would finish off the fifth, which is Henry himself.
Yes, and his injuries were minor. I mean, they were not anything compared to the injuries sustained by the other, you know, the other family members. And you must also look at the pathology of that crime. I mean, anyone will tell you. Look, what's interesting for me is these guys, you know, from the evidence that's being presented by the state, came into that house without weapons. If the state's evidence is supported, they took an axe and they took a knife from inside the home. You know, one of the domestic workers who worked there said she'd seen that axe looked very similar to an axe that was, you know, where she used to fetch, I think it was the ironing board. So now you have the scenario where these people come into an environment unarmed, and then they access these weapons within the house on the version of the state. Of course, Henry saying he doesn't recognize that axe. And then carry out this horrific crime, which have all, on a sort of, if you had to walk into that crime scene, independent of anything else that you'd seen, that is pure rage, what is going on there. You know, that,
and it's
like,
personal.
That is a rage,
it's got to be personal.
Rage crime.
This is not someone who, you don't axe murder someone just because you want them dead. You axe murder someone because you want them to die in a horrible way. Mm. It just seems like such a well thought through, premeditated, ugly, nasty, vicious, you know, kind of, there's a motivation there. You don't attack people with an axe just because you want them dead.
Yeah, I mean, it's really one of the most, I mean, I've done a few axe murder cases. And I mean, if you look at the blood spatter evidence, the level of blood, the level of trauma, you know, the postmortems, it's very gruesome. And what's also important to note here is that, you know, it very much appears the brother was attacked in his bed while he was sleeping. So, I mean, the guy did not have a chance. To really, really do anything. And I think that, you know, that whatever happens here, you know, if it is indeed a case where Henry van Bedaar's guilt is proven and accepted by the court and he is convicted and sentenced and then no doubt goes through a whole range of appeals, I don't think we're ever going to get to a stage where we have insight into what may have motivated this. Mm. Because there's this wall around this family. And I think that's part of the enormous kind of, you know, interest or pull into why we want to understand this, because they're this well-to-do family. We have hints of these underlying tensions, but, you know, these were extremely wealthy people, extremely successful, everything going for them. And yet one night, 2015, all hell breaks loose, and we still really don't have a sense as to why.
Karen, what is the total number of charges that Henry is facing, and what kind of sentences do those charges hold should he be found guilty on all of them?
Well, he's obviously for the three murders, and then for the attempted murder of the sister, and then defeating the ends of justice, because they're saying that he, you know, tried to stage the crime scene to fit his version. Under the Minimum Sentences Act, you know, if the court finds that, like, it's a premeditated Schedule 1 attack, then, you know, it's life sentence unless he can show substantial and compelling circumstances justifying the imposition of a lesser sentence. I'm not entirely sure for defeating the ends of justice, but attempted murder, I think, is around 15 years. So, or like a minimum of 10. So, yeah, it's a very... Yeah, they're very, very, very serious charges. And I think given that, you know, there were three people that were killed and then this near-fatal attack on the young woman, who my understanding is the sister is going to be living with kind of the consequences of what has happened to her for the rest of her life. And I think that if there is a conviction, yeah, the state will very much raise that as an aggravating factor.
Well, Karen, that's all we got time for this morning, I'm afraid. But thank you very much for giving us some of your time. And I do want to get you in here at a point in the very near future to talk to you about Batabile Dlamini.
God.
Has she let you into any of her press conferences lately?
No, but you know what the terrible thing is that she confused me with Annika Larson.
Oy, oy, oy.
And Annika is this very sweet, like, Annika's my colleague in Cape Town. She does Parliament.
Yeah.
And we suspect, But she's blonde. I'm blonde. I mean, I'm sort of a lot taller than Annika. But
are you saying that you're not as friendly and are you not as nice and soft and gentle and friendly as Annika is?
No. Well, I mean, I'm like a lot more. You know. Anyway, I'm not going to have this debate with you. Anyway, so she went off at Annika in Parliament.
Oh no.
Because she thought it was me, to the point where another journalist, who a reputable journalist, actually nearly burst into tears, because he's like, "Please don't do this. Please don't do this, Minister." And she was shouting at Annika, wow. "How dare you call me ma'am? And how dare you this? And how dare you that?" Oh, and I said to Annika, "Dude, I actually think she thought, you know, she's like, she thought I was you, Karen.
She hates
thought
I was you. You. She hates
so,
you.
So I mean, so no, she does. She and I mean, at one stage after that first incident, there was a prayer meeting where, you know, they were praying about God must drive the spectre of evil that is this unnamed journalist away. And, so, I mean, look, I don't have anything against her. I just, you know, like, this is an important issue. And I really, you know, we have to ask questions. I just, better be less shame. That's all I'm going to say on that particular issue.
Karen, thank you. We'll get you in here to talk about all these things at some point in the near future. Thanks.
Cool, man. Thanks, guys.
Cool. There you go. Karen Morn from ENCA. 26 after 7, there's lots of other news. Sia has a to-do list. Balesa, please bring me that to-do list of Sia's. You got to see this. It's written on a whiteboard at the desk that Sia's using.
Oh, okay. That's very organized of you, Sia.
Good. There's a to-do
I'm just
list.
Being productive.
There's a to-do list for Balesa, and then there's one for Sia. I'll start with Balesa's. Listen to this. Podcasts, music for no borders, weekend schedule, ads for next week, all that stuff, right? And yeah, she's ticked them all.
She works hard for money, Ron.
She really does. All of Balesa's things are ticked off.
Oh.
Then it says Sia.
Okay.
Number one, continue being fabulous.
Wow.
Number two, take over the world. Number three, get Oprah to adopt him.
I don't know about you guys, but these are things I need to accomplish.
Well, you've done point one.
Oh,
as far as I'm concerned, yeah.
Oh, that's so nice. Isn't that
I
nice?
Need to stay on the ball, need to accomplish these, so, you know, we make these happen.
Oh, okay, well, the fantastic. World later, your enclave now. How are you going to deal with axe murdering when it's in dispute in your enclave?
Well,
in my fabulous world, that doesn't happen.
Will the vibe of the person on the stand be taken into account?
That is a very good question, Gord. No one has ever asked that of a journalist. Would the vibe?
Yeah.
No, but I mean, the vibe is not necessarily the word, but what I meant was, if the dude just seems full of shit, and he's, but can that be factored in? He's saying, okay, I did X, I did
Gord,
Y.
Gord, I understand.
Yes.
But if you were ever allowed to ask questions in a court of law... they'd have to suspend proceedings immediately.
But it would be
this
so
guy's full of shit, Jonas. His vibe is fucked up, man.
You mentioned the cross-examination. The cross-examination is like, clearly you're being a bit of a dick here, and everything you say backs us up. So how about we just call it quits now? You adore us. You murdered people. Judge, come on. Fill in the dots from here.
You could defend him on the same basis. You could be like, now look, court. You're all going to hear this guy talk, and you're going to know he's a complete deuce. Now, he's always been a deuce. He has no friends. He's generally considered a douche. That doesn't make him a murderer. Like, let's not hold against him.
Gord,
the fact that
whether
he's
you were for the prosecution or defense, you would do either side some damage.
Yeah, your client is losing, no matter what.
All right, listen to this. Sport dick swinging was fun this morning with Ben and Gord. Please take it to the street and invite us. I want to dedicate the Nigerian pussy song to both gentlemen. Thanks, Anushka.
I haven't heard the Nigerian pussy song.
Oh, lucky
you.
I mean, what's wrong with you?
It's a lucky, nice song lucky you. With a good vibe.
It's a good vibe. No, it is. It's terrific. Here, just for you, Gord.
And Ben, too. It was dedicated to both of us.
Well,
no,
okay.
It's all yours, Gord. You can have it.
Find it.
It's both of us, Ben. Take your half of Nigerian pussy like a man.
Hang on, I just got to find the goddamn thing. Give me a second.
Oh, well...
But you know, Gord, have you seen the Australian movie The Castle?
Yes.
So when that's the lawyer who's very unqualified, he goes, yes. "But my lord, it's just the vibe. It's
against the Constitution.
It's the vibe, and basically, it's just the vibe of it."
This is against the Constitution.
There it is.
Nigerian pussy is the tightest. Ghanaian pussy is not. Damn. Nigerian pussy is the softest. Okay. Niger pussy is the cream of the crop. Niger pussy make a nigga wanna pay. I grab it off the shelf and he buy it right away. I make you fall in love, you put nothing else above. Now we rolling in a car that you bought me yesterday.
There we go. Isn't that nice?
Now you know.
Wow.
All right. Please get Gord to call in for sport more often. Fuck it, Ben. Arsenal, as a sports guy, you should know Arsenal's never going to win anything with Arsene Wenger at the helm. I'm always on your side when Gord comes in. Gord, you really bring out the asshole in Ben, Vince.
Why am I being
like
an asshole?
Like it's my fault.
No, Gord brings it on. Russell Brand has a show on Sundays on a UK radio station, Radio X. Listen by a tune-in. Great show. Sean, okay. Sorry if you guys have mentioned this before, but why is the interview part of the podcast gone from the iOS podcast app? We've just changed categories, so the it's now under Garrett's guest. It's not part three. So if you're looking for it, it'll be found under Garrett's guests. That's where all the interview parts are now. If Henry axed his family, says Kelly, wouldn't he be covered in their blood? Do we know if he was or what state he was in after the attack?
You know, it's a really good question,
though. It's a good question.
Like, that seems like an obvious question. You can't axe murder. In my limited experience with axe murdering, you can't do it without getting some on yourself.
Yeah, I mean, it's like eating spaghetti.
Exactly,
it's
like
pretty
that.
Right. Dangerous.
Oh, precisely, okay. Identical to eating spaghetti.
Two quick announcements today. It's Tuesday. It's Wednesday, so we've got a new episode of Disrupt with Mpumi Nhlapo. And of course, just yesterday they talked about whether brands should be more inclusive or disruptive in the changing business of media, advertising, and public relations. I think we know the answer, but you can find out and you can hear the conversation. Disrupt with Mpumi Nhlapo tackled the topic yesterday with KLM Publicity MDs Kelebohile Mabunda and also BWD Advertising MD Bongani Rosa. And the headliners MD at Headliners Media, Luyanda Nene. Listen and learn how to disrupt or be disrupted. It's all powered by T-Systems South Africa. That's Mpumi Nhlapo's show. Disrupt. Every Wednesday is a brand new podcast. Every Tuesday, a live show on cliffcentral.com. And while we're talking about stuff that happens on cliffcentral.com, there's an interesting episode of Laws of Life worth checking out. Firearm legislation for every gun enthusiast. That's right. Laws of Life right here on cliffcentral.com. Go and take a listen to that too. It's all available on our website. I got an email from somebody. Taryn says, I've been listening to your conversation this week about people being too influenced by the general feelings in South Africa and divisive nature of posts on social media. I'm surprised you haven't touched on the page that went viral this weekend. There's a guy called Lawrence who calls himself the Joe Burger. He posted a series of posts calling on everybody in different races to ask each other questions about each other. At first I dismissed them, but when they popped up in my feed again and again, I started seeing some comments and the reaction to the comments, and I was really blown away. Everyone was very positive, and the threads were full of humor. Wow, it's almost like the old days on social media. One of my favorite comments was, "Dear white people of corporate South Africa, standard room temperature is 23 degrees. Can you kindly refrain from setting the air conditioner to 80 below van ons hemel?"
It's just...
Kind regards, black South Africans. Isn't that cool?
It is insane the kind of aircon levels that white people can handle.
I don't.
It's just out of this world.
We built for
it
the
is
Arctic
out
winter.
Of this world.
We built for the Arctic winter, especially the overweight ones. I am built to survive like 4 naked weeks in Scandinavia.
The owner of the page wrote, "To everyone involved in my hashtag fuck racism silly questions campaign, I'd like to thank you all from the bottom of my heart. I'm a 23-year-old South African. I've been out of the country for a little while. I saw so many depressing, racist things happening back home, so I decided I'm going to try and bring the country together. You guys make headlines. I'm so proud of you all. Love you." And I think that's very cool. You know, there are people who are managing to break through all this ugliness, because all it is ugliness over and over again. Everybody trying to one-up each other, trying to be nastier, trying to be more outraged. Try to be more funny. I will award points for people who are funny.
Or just nicer.
Nicer and funnier. The two go together.
Nice and funny.
Oh,
they go together like bread and honey. This, I tell you, brother. You can't have one.
Then I'll do your mother.
Yo.
We need our own separate podcast, Silly Songs with Gordon Garrett. No one will listen, but it will be a tour.
I will. My life is a musical.
Let's start remixing this one first.
Nigerian pussy is the tightest. Ghanaian pussy is not.
I think we should do one for every language group in South Africa.
Sure. Now you really want to start a
fight. The tightest. Afrikaans pussy is the best. Imagine. Come on, let's do one for everybody.
Engels pus is nie.
Yeah, exactly.
Look, that post was hilarious.
Someone
though.
Needs to field test that before anyone can go making bold claims.
No, I think that's
racist to be sweepingly declaring vaginas Nigerians, of a specific ethnicity.
Are you volunteering your own services?
No, I do not wish to be the tester of all known types of vagina.
Okay. I'm sure there will be quite a few people who would like to.
Yes.
Mubs, what is going on in the news?
Well, just to answer a question that was asked earlier, Gareth, regarding the Funbrada trial. Sorry, I'm just going to pick myself up from the floor.
All I heard there was like total exasperation of the name.
Fun murderer.
The question about whether there was blood on Henry. So back in September this year, police bloodstain analyst Captain Marius Hubert had testified that Bradar's version of events were inconsistent with blood spatter patterns that were found in the home. Henry had claimed that he was inside the toilet when he heard a noise from the bedroom he shared with his brother Rudy. He then opened the door slightly and saw someone attacking Rudy. But Hubert said that Henry's position was inconsistent with blood spatter patterns found on his grey shorts as well as his socks, which, according to Hubert, shows that he had been in close proximity to the source of the blood when the force was applied.
Amanda, what do you call bullshit on that?
Totally, because aren't they like 20-something? First of all, why are they sharing a room?
Exactly.
And they have money, so you can't tell me that there's not enough rooms in the house.
Yeah, we were calling bullshit this months ago.
And he said that he saw that, like, his brother getting attacked and he didn't want to intrude, but now he's saying he's in the bathroom.
I don't want to intrude, guys. No,
it's like it was a fun thing that he was doing. No, you guys keep playing.
That's a thing when you share a bedroom, like, look, guys, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to intrude. I just want to go have a quick wee.
What I was thinking, like, when we were talking to Karen, is that I think him and his sister were part of this whole thing. They did it.
Oh, my God. You're pulling the sister in?
No, I think they did it. And then he didn't kill his sister fully.
Fully?
She says she doesn't.
I need a lightly killed sister.
She says she doesn't remember everything. And then he probably said to her, if you do tell, I will come out and ask you some way. So I think she's just like... not remembering.
Well, according to what Karen's saying, she might even be a little bit brain damaged. I mean, I'm starting to hear that that's the problem, is that she's actually not, she's like retarded now.
But now I read an article that she's at school and she's back at school.
No.
She's probably
that.
At a school. But I mean, like, we all remember the story of how her boyfriend at the time was like, I would kill for you, and there was disputes in the family.
And the other part of this that nobody seems to be bringing up is that Henry, they say, had a big problem with Tick.
Yeah.
Yes.
I mean, how else do you keep watching Star Trek?
No, that.
Yeah, at some point.
You've got to be on substances if you still find Star Trek and maybe you want to watch.
Oh, Henry, my honey.
At some point, him and the girlfriend were facing drug charges.
Yeah.
I'd like to point out something a little.
He's a tickhead.
Yeah, he's. Well, here's something even more frightening is that Sia finds him attractive and even thinks that when he was giving testimony, he was so cute and sexy. That's what Sia said.
And it's not even Cocktober anymore, so you know he means it now.
Okay, hold up, evil. There was just something about the tone of his voice that gave a little bad boy-ness to it.
Oh, yeah, my
he
God.
Killed his family. The bad boy has been established, okay? Yes. We've ticked that box.
Yeah,
he's just talking like this the entire time.
Yeah, you there's levels of bad boys here. You want someone with a Harley and maybe like a fiery temperament. Yeah.
You're just
not like
those
axe
women.
Murderers are.
Axe murderers a little bit too bad boys, Sia. Yeah.
You're just like those women who send letters to murderers in prison.
Yeah.
And then they end up marrying them.
I used to judge them.
I have to agree with Sia, though. Like, he's got these eyes, like I was looking at him just now. There's something about him.
You two need your heads read.
No,
he's cute.
I'm booking the two of you in for an evaluation.
Look, I'm not saying I want to run into the sunset with the guy, but I'm just saying.
You'll be running.
You want to run from him.
You'll be running.
Happy dying.
Enjoy, Sia. You and your boyfriend. You two can go along. Have a happy time.
Henry. Oh, right. So let's continue with some sort of cases, right?
Oh, yeah, that's the ceiling case. Yeah, let's hear
an
about
update
that.
On the man in the ceiling.
Oh, so, what a feeling.
Just have to carry on the beat there.
Shut up.
Just a bit of a recap. We spoke about this last week, and there was a man who was discovered in a Stellenbosch hospital, and more specifically, the ceiling of a Stellenbosch hospital, after he had disappeared 13 days earlier. And yeah, he was found by construction workers who were doing renovations in the ceiling. So the man has now been identified as a 61-year-old. His name is Teteke. My goodness. Teteke. I know, that's quite a mouthful.
Teteke.
That's
a stutter.
Henry
doesn't have a stutter. That whoever named that child does.
Parents probably just wanted to name him Teke.
Wait, after and that then, name, where do we go with the surname?
Oh, are you ready for this? Surname GQOTSI. Kotsi.
Teteke Kotsi.
How many T's? Three.
Teteke Kotsi.
So he was the man in the ceiling.
He was the man in the ceiling.
That's
61 years old.
That's quite onomatopoeic. You know, he's crawling in the ceiling.
I'm not laughing. I'm not.
And then the surname?
Kotsi, when he falls.
See what I mean?
This poor gentleman has passed away.
You can make an interpretive dance.
Kotsi. He climbed into the roof. And then with a mighty fall, Kotsi landed.
All right, tell us more.
Sir. All 100 liters of him hit the ground.
All 100 liters.
Oh, that's so bad. As we were, Mr. Kotsi is 61 years old and a father of six, and he was actually found in an isolated area of the hospital after he had undergone surgery. So now the Western Cape Health Department has once again stuck with their story of saying that a nurse was attending to him after he was recovering from surgery, which was abdominal surgery, and the nurse was just off to fetch some clean linen, and when she came back, that was when Kotsi had disappeared. So his brother has now gone on to comment on behalf of the family, and he says that he doesn't understand because Mr. Kotsi actually could not walk because of the operation they had done on him. So what has shocked us, he says, is the discovery of his body in the area where he was found after he had disappeared for almost 2 weeks.
Okay, but here's the thing that bothers me.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost like that story that came up in the news not so long ago about that missing girl. And her family, they didn't report her. Someone found the body before the family said that he was missing.
Oh,
do you know what I mean?
Oh, like, I didn't think of that.
The family don't report that he's missing. He's in the hospital. And they don't think it's at all suspicious that he's just not in the hospital for 2 whole weeks. Only when they find the body, they're like, oh, yeah, that's Teteke.
Oh, well, here's the thing, though. They are based in the Eastern Cape.
The family.
And this happened
in the
Western
Cape. So is he on his own
in
the Western
yes.
Cape? Oy, oy, oy.
They said that we have received a phone call on October 7 asking us if he was not here at home. We told them that he was at the hospital, but they said he was not there and that he had left. That's when they all rushed to hospital. One of the nurses said that the last time she had seen him was around 5:15 in the morning, and they searched inside and outside of the hospital. They came back with the police the following day, but they still nonetheless found nothing. The department is still investigating.
Baffling. This is baffling.
Yeah, how he ended up in the ceiling.
Do they know, like, what kind of ceiling conditions? Is it one of those where you just push a... You know the ones, it's like almost like tiles?
Yeah. Mm.
And you can push them in... Yeah, exactly, precisely like those, yeah. Except lower, ideally. You can just push them in and get straight in, or do you need to climb through a duct? Like, there's levels of ceiling.
Well, if we quote their statement, they said it's an isolated part.
In other words, he crawled quite far.
Yeah.
Wait, so did you say what the cause of death is?
The autopsy still hasn't been released yet, but all the department is also saying on that is that they'll discuss it with the family first.
Because, I mean, if you are 61 years old, number one, you're not fresh.
Mm-hmm.
Then no, you've.
Well, depends with what stage.
You're not ripe anymore. You're kind of, you know, going on the
it's
other
not
end.
Too juicier.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you've also just had surgery, right?
Mm-hmm.
So how
which they say he couldn't walk like so he hadn't fully
yeah,
recovered.
How and why
somebody okay well
do
if
you
he can't
crawl
walk
into the ceiling?
No, you don't. Someone puts you in the ceiling, but why and yeah. who and for what reason the ceiling? If you've just been bradard for no real reason, and the best
that's
way,
not a term bradard
the best the way to like if you bradard someone and you're like oh shit I just bradard them, and like you put someone in the ceiling, it's a hiding place.
And you can't do
and
it
you
alone.
You don't hide there yourself because something's worrying you, and then hide there until you die of it. Like you off someone and you put them in the ceiling.
We don't know.
Yeah, well.
A bit of an update on that.
So you know who else is a sexual predator?
Oh, well, who isn't these
yeah,
days?
Yeah, who isn't?
Andy Dick.
No.
Who's Andy Dick again?
Exactly.
Oh.
So no, I'm being serious. No,
so Andy know. Dick is like that kind of guy. I mean, his name is very appropriate. It's that kind of like weedy looking guy who's always that
Andy?
Bit. He's always that bit part.
Yeah, he's an comedy actor. He's done a lot of
person.
Sitcoms and yeah.
Yeah, he's got like a funny squeaky voice. He just looks like a bit of a creep. So he's been taken off independent movie because of sexual harassment.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So he said, look, I haven't groped anybody, but basically I'm... He says he hasn't groped anybody or anything like that, but what his thing is that he likes to lick people's cheeks.
Oh my god!
That is so disgusting.
Like involuntarily with them
lick
going,
people.
No,
don't lick my
just
cheek,
saying,
Andy. Like, it's kind of my thing. Like, he's like, he's trying to make it sound like he's interesting. Look, the only person who ever basically pulled off a cheek licking incident and it was successful was Tommy Lee and Pamela Anderson. That will go down as 90s courtship. Oh. But
he licked more than cheek, let me
well,
tell you.
Exactly, Gord, but I mean, let's not go too far into this. Andy Dick, nobody
well,
wants
Tommy
you.
Went pretty far in.
Oh, no. Wait, is he saying this in a joking
No,
manner,
he's saying it as in like,
for real?
He's saying it as in like, that's just kind of my thing. Live would deal with it.
But like, oh, sure. Voluntarily or involuntarily, like, does he spring it on people or does
well,
he go, now listen, if
Gord,
you
I don't,
want to sit in the dick room,
yeah.
you've got to get your cheek licked.
I would be upset if someone just licked my cheek.
I would slap them across
yeah,
the...
I'd
no,
punch
I'd punch
him,
in the throat.
Face.
Yeah.
I would commit bodily harm.
Depends who.
A tweet from Linda Sasso, who was one of the leaders of the Women's March in Washington. She's this white chick from like middle class white suburbia who's converted to Islam. She tweeted this morning after that terror attack in New York, "Acts of terror don't belong to any faith. Let's focus on the victims and their families and pursue full justice for them." And someone replied to her with a chart from Wikipedia that lists violent deaths by ideology in the last year. Anarchism, one person. Angolan nationalism, one person. Anti-abortionism, one person. Anti-Castroism, one person. Anti-feminism, one person. American nationalism, one person. Assamese separatism, one person. Amshrikyo, one person. Basque nationalism, three people. Communism, three people. Criminal activities, four people. Irish republicanism, eight people. Kurdish nationalism, four people. Maoism, two people. Militant trade unionism, one person. Misogyny, one person. Neo-fascism, two people. Unknown, seven people. Ulster loyalism, one person. Zionism, two people. White supremacism, one person. And then Islamism, 273 people. Case closed. Stop this crap of acts of terror don't belong to any faith. Of course they don't belong to. But there is one faith that is completely overrepresented. No matter how you slice it and dice it. And you can go and look at charts over 5 years, charts over 20 years. You can compare it with deaths in war. You can compare it with pretty much anything. There's one ideology that is overrepresented in all of these charts.
Do you think there's a direct correlation between that and how sort of prescribed it is within that ideology to be okay to spread the ideology using violence? Like,
absolutely. It's in the founding documents.
It's in the founding documents, right? Yeah. I'm not no expert. I don't pretend to have read them. I haven't read anybody's whole founding
document. In the founding documents, there's no way around it. In fact, it's a source of great embarrassment to Muslim scholars who don't have cognitive dissonance, who are interested in this as a study of religion, because there's no way around it.
So what does it essentially say?
It's perfectly okay. Particularly Wahhabi Islam says it's perfectly okay. And remember, there are a number of interpretations of the Quran and then of the various hadith references which come out after. It's almost like in Judaism you have the Torah and then you have the Talmud. The Talmud are the interpretations of the Torah, the scholarly thoughts, the additions to it. It's like an addendum.
Okay.
And in the hadith and in the Quran,
handbook,
there are various very explicit injunctions to violence, and particularly violence to those who are not of their faith. So I just find it very hard to, and it's not my problem to do this, to cut this up and make it fit into modern society, because it doesn't. Most religions don't. Everybody looks at the Bible, they cherry-pick these parts, Christians, Jews, Muslims, whatever it might be. They cherry-pick the parts that make it sound like it's a great philosophy that adds value to the world and lets people get along, love thy neighbor, and all that stuff. Conveniently, they leave out the part where you have to stone your daughter if she has sex before marriage. Or burn a witch.
You know, like I find, that's another thing I find funny about religion is that in life, all as humans, we take the low road, the easy road, or absolutely everything. Why do we want to complicate our lives with all these books and all these scriptures when all we need to do is the two commandments of life, don't be a puss and be lekker?
Yeah.
So we can just live on two things and go forward from there. Why do we have to make things so complicated about burning bushes and how you mistreat females and
talking snakes?
What this guy said on that mountain. Just think of these two things and just carry on.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, when that kind of thing is drilled into you from the time that you are a maggot, it's very difficult.
That's such an optimistic view on the development of humans. But
small and squishy brain.
The human life cycle, according to
Small and squishy brain. Okay. Like, it's game over for you.
Yeah.
And it's terrifying. I mean, people don't acknowledge. I had a conversation about it with a friend of mine who claims to be religious, but like just says she is. She's like, oh yeah, fully Jesus, and then just lives an ordinary life.
It's kind of like Man United fans. They just want to be part of
Precisely
something.
Precisely like that, Ben. Thanks. but I said to her, like, is it not? She said, it's easier. It feels safer to just be observant. It's like, you're terrified of hell, and hell is a terrifying concept. And even if your rational brain as an adult tells you, okay, that doesn't make any logical sense, it's contradictory that a thing that's ever loving and merciful will create things to put them in a place like hell, still, if you believe there's a chance that, I mean, that is a terrifying thing to explain to a 5-year-old or a 7-year-old or even anyone younger than 21 that it's possible.
Well, you have to be profoundly wicked to introduce the idea of eternal punishment to an infant mind. You have to be such a vicious, cruel. I mean, you know, I feel bad telling my nephews scary stories that don't involve monsters and things that don't exist. But to imagine telling them with a good, pure heart, because you've been taught this yourself, and your parents were taught that, and your grandparents were taught that, so you just carried it on. You didn't question it. Imagine sitting a child down and saying to them, if you're not good, you're going to burn in hell forever and be tormented by devils and demons and
actually on fire.
Forever.
Tortured. Yeah.
Forever. And this is where, you know,
and unless you
I'm
the
sorry,
following.
But this is a question of what they call eschatology, which is the study of the end. And Christian scholars are obsessed with this stuff. And Christianity has to own this. Before gentle Jesus, meek and mild, came along, there was never an idea of eternal damnation. There's no hell in Judaism. It was introduced particularly by this new kind of religion that developed in the Middle East about 2,000 odd years ago. They've got to own it. And introducing hell created so much pain and so much misery for so many people.
And you got like those, in my experience, it seems like those American sort of subdivisions of Christianity are the biggest into it, like the Pentecostals. They like celebrate it. They almost like can't wait for everyone else to go to hell.
These sulfur and brimstone. Yeah, exactly.
Goddamn these, homosexual these non-American
and
lover.
Brimstone guys up there spitting at their audience with just the talk. They go into detail about what's going to happen to your genitals when the monsters in hell get hold of them. Sia would hate it.
You're still going to have a fist.
Hell is coming for you.
And they're going to bedaw your genitals for all time.
According to my life, then I have like a VIP pass to that life. So
it's all right, man. I'll see you there.
Oh, should I keep the seat warm?
The aircon's going to be set to white people.
Not in hell. Not in hell. In hell, it's
no.
flaming hot.
Yes. Definitely not. Listen to this quickly. Here's hell. Here's what happens in hell.
Well, let's take hell. You know, hell isn't as bad as it's cracked up to be. What? No. No, you see, the thing about heaven is that heaven is for people who like the sort of things that go on in heaven. Like, singing, talking to God, watering pot plants. Whereas hell, on the other hand, is for people who like the other sorts of things. Adultery, pillage, torture. Those areas.
Really?
Leave your lands to the crown, and once you're dead, you will have the time of your life.
Adultery, pillage, through all eternity.
Yep.
Isn't that terrific?
Yeah,
all right, that's from Blackadder. He goes into a nice description of hell. All right, we've got to wrap this up for this morning. Gord, thanks very much for popping
so
by.
So cool to be here. Thanks, guys.
As always, Ben, thank you very much. Amanda, thank you. Mabale Moloi, thank you very much. And Sia, who's dressed in his Roger outfit today. Sia, thanks very much. Are we going to do the planking for Gary?
Of course we
Damn
are.
Right
outside,
we are.
Outside, Gareth. Right. We can do it with some space.
We will do some planking for Gary in the next little while, but before we get to that, it's time for the unnews. Here are the important things that you need to know this morning. Danny Yordan looks set to break his silence over the numerous rape allegations against him, and by breaking his silence, he will, of course, deny everything and remind everyone what a success the 2010 FIFA World Cup was, and that he was key to making this happen. Speaking of sexual predation, more and more men are coming forward with allegations that Kevin Spacey made inappropriate sexual advances on them. Spacey supports the allegations, saying since they've started happening, his interactions on Grindr have increased tenfold. Silver lining. South Africa is officially the preferred candidate to host the 2023 Rugby World Cup. World Rugby decided this, and a judging panel now has to move on whether to uphold this recommendation. Takes place on November the 15th, so Cyril Ramaphosa has urged all South Africans to keep it together on the crime and corruption front for at least the next 2 weeks, and once the hosting is confirmed, you can return to your criminal ways of adultery, pillaging, and other things. See you tomorrow between 6 and 8, and coming up next, a pretty damn interesting interview. I sat down with a woman who's done the first biographical book on Nkosasana Dlamini Zuma, who could be our president. So I sat down with Corinne Duplessis yesterday and we discussed the book that she's written called Woman in the Wings. That's coming up next.
This is CliffCentral.com.